Finding Our Way is proudly sponsored by Berghaus, a team of people united by their passion for the outdoors and who are working hard to create more diversity in the sports we love. For more detailed information, go and have a look at the episode description. Hello, I'm Marianne O'Hotter, and a very warm welcome to the start of the second season of Finding Our Way, the podcast that aims to diversify the voices we normally hear talking about the outdoors. It's brought to you by the British Mountaineering Council, the BMC. In each episode of Finding Our Way, we talk to someone who's usually busy climbing, mountaineering, or walking, and we want to know from them, what have you learned from your adventures? We're looking for different perspectives, we want to challenge the norms, and we want to celebrate the people who are making real change happen. So it's a very great pleasure to kick off our new season with a pair of mountain men who are pushing the boundaries in all manner of ways. Leo Holding is one of the world's most accomplished adventure climbers. He started when he was 10 and has spent the best part of his adult life nailing big walls, new routes and leading expeditions to tackle remote and challenging climbs in very far-flung corners of the planet. His new memoir, Closer to the Edge, has just been released and he's got a new film too, House of the Gods, about his expedition to Mount Roraima in the Amazon. That's out now. Ed Jackson used to be a professional rugby player until an accident diving into the shallow end of a swimming pool broke his neck. Ed is now an adaptive adventurer, committed to using his own experience to inspire others, and through his charity Millimeters to Mountains, helping other people who've suffered trauma, both physical and psychological, to find their way back to a positive place. Separately brilliant, these two also climb together. They're taking on big challenges in the mountains and redefining adventure as they do it. Connecting with us from the Lake District and from Bath, welcome, Leo Holding and Ed Jackson. It is a pleasure to talk to you.
Morning.
Pleasure. Morning.
Hello. Hello. Okay, so tell me, how did you two get together? How did you start going into the mountains together?
Do you want to start?
Leo, do you want to take... Oh, go on then. Well, I mean, that's a very long story, to be honest, because it would involve my accident, how I got into mountains in the first place. But how I met Leo was I'd set up a charity to raise money for a spinal unit in Nepal, and we were heading out to Mira Peak to climb Mira Peak, and I sent a email or I wrote to all the outdoor companies just asking if anyone would help us out with some kit, some coats, and Berghaus were one of only two people to get back to me, and they very kindly offered to support us and send us some gear. And then from then on, I started doing a bit more work with them, and they were supporting the charity. And obviously, Leo being the lead athlete at Berghaus, I met him that way. And that's how it all started. And now he's got me hanging off all sorts of ridiculous mountains. I don't really know how it got to that point.
It was quite funny though, because I'd seen a little bit of what Ed was up to, but the former boss of Berghaus, who's also a mate of mine, rang me up and said, "Hey, we've got this guy, Ed, he's doing some really cool stuff. He wants to climb Mont Blanc, but he's a quadriplegic. Do you think you could help?" And what Kev forgot to say was the partial quadriplegic part. And I kind of said, well, you know, with my limited understanding, which has become a lot greater, not just of Ed's injuries, but generally of spinal cord injuries, I was a bit like, well, I'm not sure, because my interpretation of quadriplegic meant somebody who basically couldn't move below the neck. And I'm always up for a challenge, but I thought that might be a bit too much of a challenge, because, you know, although Mont Blanc gets done a lot, it's definitely not it's not an entirely straightforward climb, and it's definitely not a trekking peak. But then I found out that Ed's injuries, although he when he first broke his neck in that accident, you basically were full quadriplegic for a while, right? But then his spinal cord wasn't completely severed. And in the last 2 years or whatever it is we've been hanging out, I've learned a lot more about what spinal cord injuries are and how they manifest themselves and whatnot. And that's how it started, really, wasn't it, mate?
Yeah. And I think, just to sort of put a footnote on that, the term quadriplegia, I think people, including myself, before I had this accident, you just picture someone who can't move anything in a wheelchair from the neck down. But quad obviously means four limbs. So basically anyone who's broken their neck, that means you'll have four limbs affected. And paraplegic means two limbs. So anyone who's broken their back, that'll be just their legs affected. But then you have complete and incomplete injuries. So complete injury would mean that you're going to have no recovery below that level. So that's what you'd imagine with people who have to control wheelchairs with their mouth and things like that. And then you've got incomplete, which is me, which means you can be walking around. I'm hobbling around. I'm still affected by the effects of my injury. So movement down the left side is poor. I've got weakness, but then the underlying health things as well, bladder, bowel, sexual function, spasms, temperature regulations, all of these exciting things that we're trying to have negotiate with the help of Leo and other people in the mountains out to face. But I'm an incomplete quadriplegic, would be the term, but I can completely I can sympathize with Leo when he heard the term quadriplegic. Get him up a mountain. I know you've got good rope access skills and stuff, mate, but that would have been a bit far-fetched.
So did you have a sort of history of going to the mountains before your accident, or was your focus rugby?
No, my focus was rugby, but actually I was thinking about this the other day because my mum got this box of photos out of me when I was a little kid, and in most of them, almost all of them, I'm outdoors. So despite the accent and the fact that I call it Bath and not Bath, the rest of my family are from up where near Leo lives, and a lot of them are farmers. So most of my childhood was spent on the farm, especially during the summers. And out in the hills. And then, you know, I think being lucky enough to go and play professional rugby, but I spent my whole life outside doing that as well. So I think the fact that I've been drawn back into the outdoors isn't surprising, but in terms of mountains themselves, I mean, I'd been skiing a couple of times. That was the extent of it, really.
Was it Snowdon was the first climb that you did after your accident? What was it that kind of made you go, that's where I need to be, that's the place that I need to be recovering in?
Do you know, it all sort of happened by chance. It wasn't like, okay, I'm going to go to the mountains because that's where I'm going to heal, or they're going to have this profound impact on my life. It was just, I was 9 months post operation. I'd been in hospital for 4 months. I was still using a wheelchair, but I was starting to take steps and walk, and I was doing so much rehab every day of my life. But 9 months down the line, it was hard to stay motivated, really, because before, if I'd had long-term rehabs from rugby injuries, there'd be you could put a pin in the diary basically of what game you're going to aim for, or what's if you're going to try and get back for the next season. So you had this end goal, but I didn't, and so I wanted to put something in place. So that was one of the reasons I did it, was to motivate my recovery, or motivate myself to carry on with my recovery. The other reason was I wanted to try and inspire other people in hospital who had also been given a negative or guarded prognosis, because I realized that there was plenty of people there who were also told that they were never going to walk again. But maybe that wasn't necessarily the case. But if they genuinely believed that and didn't try, then that would be the case. You know, the recovery starts with you, really. You've got to believe you can get better and put the effort in. And just to add a caveat there, like your recovery does depend massively on the nature of your injury. So if you have a complete spinal cord injury, it doesn't matter how hard you try. Often you've got to wait for a medical breakthrough or things won't change. But there were plenty of people, including myself, you know, I was told I was never going to walk again. If I believed that and not tried, then I wouldn't have. Luckily, I had other people giving me advice and examples of doing that. So I wanted to try and send a message to those people. And I also wanted to try and raise money for one of the charities that had supported me up until that point. And Snowdon just happened to be a hill that I'd been up before with rugby training, and it's got a pretty decent path up it. I didn't actually think I'd get to the top. I just wanted people to see me on my feet so they'd have that direct sort of comparison. But then ended up having this amazing weekend where I opened it up through my blog for anyone to come and join in. And there were 70 people there on the start line that I didn't know, who had just come to support us. And obviously then the pressure was on to get to the top, which we did. It took about 9 hours, when previously, you know, I'd run up and down it in a couple of hours. So just as a contrast, that's where I was at. But I just stood on top of Snowdon with all these amazing people who had come for their own reasons, and it lit a fire in me a little bit. So then I was just looking at what's the next one, where can I go from here, and things just sort of snowballed from there, really. So it wasn't a conscious decision to go to the mountains. It was kind of just, I want to do something as a challenge for myself, and then everything else developed from there.
Do you find it helpful, or is it actually a hindrance at times, this sort of, you know, often I think particularly with spinal injuries from the outside, it looks like sometimes there's that kind of idea, the stories of the miracle recovery, that you're a hero. Don't get me wrong, what you're doing is awesome. But does that sort of come with a burden as well as a blessing?
Yeah, that's a good point. I know, I suppose so. I felt a lot of pressure from the start. Like, people were saying, oh, you know, you're a professional rugby player, or come on, you'll be fine, you'll get back on your feet, you know, you'll get back to full health. And that just wasn't going to be the case with the nature of my injury. I was just fighting for independence, really. My first goal was to just, and my only goal was to be able to use my arms again so I could be independent. That was the only realistic end game for me that I was told by my doctors. So that's where it started. But then I started getting messages from people who had been through this process before, former Paralympians, because there was a little bit of a, you know, it was in the news briefly because of being a rugby player and all of those sorts of things. People were reaching out, and that was the inspiration that I was getting, that other people in hospital weren't, and they weren't being told that, because I had a different sort of network, luckily, because of that exposure. And I was clinging on to those people, you know, and going, you know, maybe it will, maybe it won't, but, you know, at least I've got to try. So then I sort of, then when I was in a position to basically be them, if you like, inspiring other people, I wanted to pass that on. That's all I was doing. I wasn't off on my own mission, just trying to be a hero. It was me just trying to pass on the inspiration that I'd received already, and also just test my own limitations, really.
Okay, so speaking of testing limits, Mont Blanc, let's talk about that first expedition plan that you two, you know, boiled up together. How did that come about? And then, I guess, Leo, from your perspective, how did you plan it in terms of strategy, kit, route choice? Like, how much had to change for you and Ed to be able to climb together?
Well, the first step was to meet each other and see if he was a dickhead or not, and he wasn't. So
was that a mutual audition?
I don't know. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because it does, you know, irrelevant of injuries or whatnot. I don't want to go and climb a mountain with someone who I don't get along with. It's a really important part of the process for me. It's not just for kind of generating PR or raising awareness, or, you know, clearly that was going to be an aspect to climbing Mont Blanc with Ed, but primarily it was to see, you know, what kind of, you don't want to go into the mountains into a high stress, high risk situation with someone that you don't get along with. But also on a more practical level, it was to see the extent of his injuries and abilities. So we met up in the Lake District, and we went up Scarfell Pike. And also, I've never climbed Mont Blanc before. It's not the kind of climbing that I specialize in. It's, by climbing standards, it is a pretty straightforward ascent. But it's, you know, it's dangerous. It's a big snowy mountain. So I brought in a good friend of mine who lives up here in the Lakes called Adrian Nellums, who's a mountain guide, fully certified mountain guide, who's done Mont Blanc a dozen times. So we could kind of just figure out whether or not it was feasible. Because it's a big step up from the stuff Ed had been doing before. You know, the trekking peaks are, correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, but they're kind of like endurance challenges, basically, right? There's not really any technical challenge, and the risk is quite limited. Much more kind of putting one foot in front of the other and having the grit and determination and, of course, fitness to grind it out. Whereas once you get onto steeper terrain, such as Mont Blanc, it's not quite that simple. It's not just about grit and determination. There are a certain level of technical aptitude that you need, not least of all when it, like, being able to lift your legs up right above a certain angle. So we went to do Scarfell Pike, and immediately I was what happened immediately is we set off out the car park, and my big wobbly mate here face planted really badly. And like Aid and I just looked at each other and were like, okay, he's like lots slighter than you used to be, but you're still what, like 15 stone or something, aren't you?
Yeah.
And he's a good like 4 inches taller than me. And on Mont Blanc, there's a lot of like high consequence terrain, which is a term we taught Ed. What did you interpret mean?
I worked it out. It took like a couple of days. He was saying low consequence, medium consequence. And I just turned around to him and I said, high consequence means death, doesn't it? And he was like, yeah. So okay, I thought so.
The fall just off and die bits, right.
Don't want to use that term.
Yeah, it sounds a bit fierce if you say that, but that's what high consequence means. And a lot of Mont Blanc is like that. You are only walking, but if you blow it really badly and trip over and fall, then that's a guide's job, is to, you know, you have your short roping all the time. But that's not something you tend to do. Short roping isn't something you do in, you know, I'm not a guide. I go climbing with my friends, and that's a technique that you don't really use in a normal climbing partnership. It's a guide client partnership. And when the client is significantly larger than you, it's more difficult, right? Because if they fall, if you don't kill the fall within a hundredth of a second, it kills you, basically, both of you. So this initial literally stepping
out. I like that using the word, the fall off and die is too fierce, but the, but it'll kill you in a hundredth of a second. That's fine. That's just
the terminology, true. Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, but what then quickly became apparent was how fit Ed was. And on the normal route up Scarfell, you know, which is one of the three peaks, gets done a lot by people who aren't kind of classical mountain folk. We were overtaking people consistently, and it isn't a great path, right? It's good enough, but there's a lot of steps and uneven terrain, and so we got to the top in standard time. Basically, we overtook quite a lot of teams, but then near the top we went off piste and we left the path and we went into more terrain that would be a bit more akin to the stuff you would encounter on Mont Blanc. And quickly it became apparent that that was a lot more challenging, wasn't it, Ed? As soon as it gets to about 45, 50 degrees, it was a lot harder for you and we went a lot slower.
Yeah. I mean, the main issues I have is my hip flexor doesn't work on the left side. Hamstring doesn't work. So lifting that leg is difficult, but also the weakness runs from my hand right through my left side, so through my core as well. And it's quite, you know, it's probably my left side of my core has probably got between sort of 5 and 10% of the strength of the right side. So it's quite a significant weakness, which means balance is an issue too. So I'm using poles all the time. So I'm reliant on 4 points of contact. So on a normal path, that's fine because you don't have to think about it so much. But as soon as there's broken ground and there's holes in between rocks, and it doesn't just take a lot of energy, but it takes a huge amount of concentration as well. So things slow down pretty significantly on those terrains, yeah.
How much of making that journey are you learning about the way your own body is responding? You know, rather than kind of going, I know how I respond in these circumstances and I can tell Leo and sort of demonstrate to him, or how much are you going, oh, turns out that bit I can do, that bit is more challenging, all these other things are happening in my body. How much of it was you learning about yourself, I guess?
It's been a huge learning curve, which is accelerated again a lot recently. I think at that point when we went up to Scarfell Pike, I'd done this kind of uneven ground before, so I knew that it was going to slow down a lot and I had to be a lot more careful. But of course, it was the first time Leo had seen me do that. Having said that, moving on from there, you know, there's no roadmap for what I'm doing in the mountains, and especially now starting to do some more climbing. And we're kind of working things out as we go, because it's not like, oh, well, just follow what that person does, or I've been here before. Most of the terrain I'm on, especially on our most recent trip, is completely new. And I think working it out and discovering more about my body and also about the different techniques and ways to get around things and through things is kind of half of the fun of it. But also my body is still evolving and changing. And I think actually being in the mountains has massively helped me. It's challenged my body in different ways than the traditional, you know, gym-based rehab, physio. You know, there's that sort of balance element, that fear element as well. Like what you're wanting to do is get your neurology firing as hard as possible, because you're trying to create new links and bust through and learn new movements. And when you've got, as Leo kindly put it, a high consequence situations or even medium consequence situations either side of you, it's like if you slip on a bit of ice or someone scares you, you can feel the hairs stand up on the back of your neck. And if your body's always in that, your neurology is always in that zone or for a long period of time and it's right on edge and it's firing really hard and you're challenging yourself to move and balance in different directions, that's really, really good rehab, neurological rehab, I think. Obviously, there's risks involved with it. But one of the main things about that people say about why younger people normally recover a bit quicker, a bit better from spinal cord injuries or something, neurological injuries, isn't necessarily just because of neuroplasticity and those sorts of things. It's actually because they're more willing to take risks. You know, if you stay sat in your wheelchair or you'll stay sat in your bed, you're not going to be challenging your body in the same ways as if you, I mean, it's pretty scary when you first start learning to walk again, even for me, because you're falling over all the time or you always feel like you're going to fall over. And I'm still like that when I'm in the mountains. I'm just getting more and more used to it. But you have to be willing to sort of get outside that comfort zone and push those limits and be a bit scared and trust in. I mean, this is why it's been amazing getting to climb with people like Leo and Aid and Waldo and these guys, because I can put my faith in them because of their experience rubs off on me and allows me to push my own limits in ways that I would never have the confidence to do by myself. And I'm now, and I'm seeing that those rewards now in neurological recovery. The past year, I've probably, I've seen more recovery than, in fact, the past 6 months, I've seen more changes in my neurology than I had for the previous 3 years, I think. So first 2 years, you see most of your recovery, and then it was quite slow and relatively static. And the last year, I've seen it kick on again, which actually goes against what you would be told by doctors and physios. You're kind of told you've got a year, potentially two, to make as much recovery as possible. But we kind of want to disprove that. And I know other people who are in a similar situation to me, who are further down the line, even 10, 15 years down the line, but keep pushing. I've been very lucky to be involved with the last two Paralympics, working on the TV side of it, but got to know quite a lot of them. They'll say that that's rubbish. You can always change your neurology, which of course makes sense. You know, you could go out and learn to play golf tomorrow. That would be changing your neurology. So I just find this is a really good way for me to fast track that, as well as all the psychological benefits you get from being outdoors with your mates and climbing and challenging yourself. There's also genuine physical knock-on effects for my recovery, which is pretty cool.
I guess that's something that you have in common, that kind of desire to find that space where you are really pushing the limits, wherever the limits are. Is that something that you sort of recognised in Ed yourself, Leo? Is that sort of what made you go, oh yeah, I get all this stuff?
I think so, but it's more, I think quite quickly. So after we did Scarfell, we went out to the Alps, but with a very big caveat that, you know, we still hadn't got very much experience. He hadn't seen him in crampons, hadn't seen him in snow, hadn't seen him on technical terrain. So to climb Mont Blanc, we needed to do a couple of warm-up ascents first and also acclimatise. And it was actually Adrian who suggested a couple of peaks in Switzerland. It was the Weissmeiss and the Alenhorn, wasn't it? Alenhorn, which were really good because they're much smaller peaks than Mont Blanc, but they've got kind of similar terrain. One of them has got kind of rocky, scrambly stuff, two-day mission from a hut and then down a glacier. The other more snow and ice, and kind of ridgy, so sort of simulating the terrain we were going to find on Mont Blanc, and it went really well. We really made a lot of progress just seeing how it went. I mean, it was slow, right? We were way slower than an average party on both of those ascents, but that's okay as long as you know and you account for that. So after like a week or 5 days climbing in Switzerland, we had a bit of a chat, and both Aid and I and Ed all concluded that, yeah, I think it's feasible that we can attempt the normal route on Mont Blanc via the Gutierrez Hut. However, we need an extra day in the schedule over what you would do with a normal client rate, which is, you know, normally people do it in 2 days. And we thought 3 would be better, just to try and time it so that you don't go through the dangerous bits at the wrong time of day. There's not loads of other people there and stuff. So that was all very exciting. And then we got totally shat on by the weather, which It doesn't matter who you are or how well you've trained or whatever, you know what I mean? The weather decides in the mountains. What was a slight kind of relief was that no one summited Mont Blanc in that 3 days, right? That it wasn't like marginal weather. Because the other thing was, not only did we need a bit more time, when you've got factors that you can't control, such as Ed's injuries, you need to really own what you can control, which is good conditions. So, you know, a lot of the time it's really windy on the top of Mont Blanc, and you can push on through that, but it's a lot colder and you're more susceptible to cold injuries. Ed hasn't got any feeling in, is it your right side of your body, isn't it, that doesn't have any feeling? So things like cold injuries, frostbite are a problem, because he's completely unaware that his toes are freezing. So yeah, we wanted really good weather, and we definitely didn't get that. During the course of those training climbs, although clearly we didn't succeed at what we set out to do, which was climb Mont Blanc, you know, it kind of opened a new door, right, Ed? And onto steeper terrain, I think until that point, for you, it was very much about getting to the top of mountains as goals, right? And you know, as he said, he started out on Snowdon, and it was kind of a rehabilitation process, having these waymarkers to aim for, to train for. But in those few days in the mountains, it's kind of like, well, look, you know, to be honest, climbing isn't really about getting to the top. That's why we don't go the easiest way. You know, they say the difference between mountaineering and climbing is mountaineering is about taking the easiest way to the top. Climbing is about taking the hardest way and not necessarily going to the top. And I think you enjoyed it, right? You were into it.
Yeah, absolutely loved it. And I think it was also because it was something that I never considered myself capable of doing even before my accident. So then to then realize that I could do it even despite my injuries. And weirdly, when I was on steeper terrain and I was engaging my upper body as well, it was allowing me to access parts of my lower body that I hadn't been able to access since my injury, just the way like the neural stretch came on. And so that was really exciting. And then also just being around people who are experts in their field, I was learning a huge amount, and having that sort of progress curve steepen again was really exciting. I was loving being that beginner who didn't have a clue what they were doing, and just like being a sponge of information and knowledge. Because I suppose having played professional rugby for 10 years or doing anything professionally for a long period of time, you get to a point where, of course, you can always get better and you can always learn more, but you feel like you know it all, or your progress curve is obviously going to be a lot flatter. And then all of a sudden being a beginner again and just learning new things every day, and also learning from people who are really elite, you know, it felt like I was that sort of academy rugby kid again who just left school and all of a sudden was surrounded by internationals in their first training session, where you're just like, whoa, this is wicked. And I absolutely loved it. And I think my mentality, Leo, is right, has changed quite a bit towards the mountains. Obviously, it's still nice to stand on top of things, but it's not just about that. And I really want to try and develop my skills in that area, in this sort of new world. And obviously my skills and my techniques are going to have to be different. You know, like I think Leo's obviously and Aid and Waldo and the people who are helping out, you know, we're having to come up with new and weird and wonderful things that aren't normal techniques, because I'm not a normal person, and I can't do things with my left side that I can do with my right. And it's just working out all these different movements. But that's kind of the fun of it as well. And Leo made a good point there. You know, it's not about, you know, pushing boundaries, you know, general boundaries. It's about pushing your own personal boundaries, I think, and trying to develop. And my boundaries are very different to other people's. And obviously, Leo's gone and done some insane things around the globe that are pushing boundaries by anyone's standards, but I'm not sure he ever expected that his next challenge would be to have a big wobbly bloke tied to the back of him. So it's a boundary, but just a different type of boundary, I suppose.
Yeah, and the flip side to that is, you know, having spent my entire adult life basically centered around climbing, it's really refreshing taking someone from a different walk of life who you get along with into that steeper terrain, because it does change. You know, I'm sure many of the people listening to this will be climbers, so they get it. But once it gets to a certain angle, a steepness, and once you get into the big steep terrain, it's a different thing. It's not like walking up a mountain. The last thing we did on that Mont Blanc trip was a thing on the Index, which was more of a proper rock climb, and it wasn't very hard, but it's really exposed. You know, you're on an arete, so it's completely 270 degrees of exposure, and it's a different thing. It's like humans are instinctually afraid of being on that super exposed high angle terrain. So I think
some more than others.
Yeah, I was going to say, you didn't seem
very scared up there, mate.
But that's because I've spent half my life literally in that environment, so I'm perfectly comfortable in it. And especially because, sort of counterintuitively, the gnarlier it gets, the safer it gets. Because when it gets steep, you start using full on rock climbing techniques, not alpine crossover short roping. You're tied to the mountain. Yeah, there's obviously still risk, especially if you don't know what you're doing, but if you do, it isn't that dangerous because you are actually tied to the cliff using more advanced rock climbing techniques all the time. So it's actually a lot safer, which is hard to get your head around initially, but it is. It's actually a lot safer than walking around on steep terrain, a lot slower. And it's kind of refreshing to just see someone's jaw drop, you know, when you... And it's really interesting as well because Ed gets properly stuck in and, you know, he's fighting hard to gain progress and he's really focusing on the physical side of things. And then every now and again, I'll poke him and be like, hey, look where we are, you know, stop. And he'll go, no.
And I'll be like, no, thanks. I'll just focus on this bit of rock right in front of me. Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Is that because if you look out, you'll be reminded of how fally-offy the situation is?
Yeah, I'm getting better at it.
That's the situation I find myself in. I'm like, I don't need to look at the view just yet.
That's definitely it. And I think because I am wobbly and this is out of my comfort zone, I've definitely got a lot more fear than Leah would have in that circumstance. I think that's just a coping mechanism to get through things, is just try not to think about it too much and just focus on the next step in front of you, listen to the advice and just push on. And that's been that has been useful for me in the past to get to the top of things. But at the same time, like, I get it when Leo says, look, just take a moment and appreciate where you are. You know, it's not just about getting to the top, you know, it's about the process and enjoying it. And I was like, well, if looking down that 2,000 feet of exposure is enjoyment to you, like, I mean, it's adrenaline, it's a buzz, like, it's great, it is great. And I am getting better at doing that. But at the same time, like Leo said, where we're climbing now, or the things we're doing, like the most recent trip, is really on the edge of my abilities, which is where it should be, you know, because that's the only way to progress. So I am having to focus a lot harder than Leo, who's just like skipping around like all around me taking photos, or, you know, or taking the piss out of me, or whatever he's doing.
There's climbs, Leo, that you've done that are objectively very high risk, that you can't put that much protection in, that you're, you know, working out the route as you go. I mean, you must recognize that experience that Ed's describing, where you're like, I just need to focus on this next incredibly tricky move, because otherwise the consequences of me making a mistake are pretty hefty.
Yeah, for sure. That's one technique to cope with fear, which is kind of denial, right? You're kind of ignoring it, but and it's very effective. But you can also embrace it, you know, and like feel that kind of fear, that rush of adrenaline, which is the initial part, and then sort of get on top of it. Like, okay, and now I'm not going to ignore it, I'm going to recognize it, and now I'm kind of going to master it and push it down. And then you can really sort of utilize that energy to drive you forward. It's not denial, you know, it's full embracement of it. And
okay,
it
how
takes
do you do
a
that?
While.
Share with us.
Breathing is the fundamental. It's you control your breathing. Which it therefore controls your heart rate. Because what happens when you get a spike of adrenaline, a spike of fear, is your heart starts going nuts. And as any athlete will know, when your heart starts beating really fast, you start building up lactic acid in your muscles. You start, it's kind of a downward spiral, right? You really, normally your heart rate goes up when you're exerting yourself, but that also comes from intense fear. So you have to try and control your heart rate, which you do by slowing your breathing and controlling your breathing. And also that's a meditative technique, which is a lot of crossover between extreme fear and meditation, where you you use similar breathing techniques, and if necessary, close your eyes and really just focus on circular slow breathing. And that gets over that initial spike of adrenaline, that initial fear. And then you can kind of use the fear to your advantage, because it does kind of, you know, it's like going into battle. You've got that kind of energy that you can really, it's like a survival energy that really is quite powerful, but hard to control. And don't get me wrong, like just ignoring it is good, because it can go the other way. If you don't get on top of it, it can totally push you down, right? And people do freak out. And I wouldn't push Ed in the way that I have been doing. If we hadn't, we've done a little bit together now, not loads and loads, but enough. So yeah, it's kind of knowing how far you can push someone. We did the Agui Dibina in the Ekran Alps a few weeks ago. And it's a proper technical summit. It's super exposed. It's not hard by rock climbing standards, but it is actually rock climbing. It's definitely not scrambling. And it was right at your limit. And what was great is that obviously, you know, there is a whole host of tricks you can use to help someone get up a mountain. Fundamentally, with the rope, you can pull them up. You can give them a bit of assistance. You can give them a lot of assistance. We also taught Ed how to jumar, how to climb ropes. Which actually your disabilities aren't that hindersome to, right? Because you can still push really well. So, but it quickly became apparent in one training session that he can jumar really well, which sort of takes the challenge out of it a bit. It's like, well, you get up anything if you do that, which is cool. We've got some ideas to do some bigger stuff down the line utilizing those techniques. But, you know, free climbing, even within the limitations that he has, is much better. It's much more of a challenge. There's so much uncertainty, you might not be able to do it. And the progress that you've made in the last sort of 18 months was remarkable. And just like little tricks, you know, like you had one climbing shoe on and one approach shoe, right? And the handle on his knee, and like these little things that we're figuring out that really helped.
Yeah, that's been another bit that's been really cool, has been adapting kit as well. It's not just adapting movement and stuff. And Leo's really helped advise on that, and Berghaus have been great. Like, I've now got loads of kit adaptations that have helped me around sort of my own limitations. But hopefully, like, other people can benefit from those as well. Like, for example, I've got a zip in my trousers that allows me to access my catheter bag, but I've got contacted by someone the other day who uses EpiPens and stuff, and being able to inject yourself in by having that access zip. And I never even thought about something like that. And like extra ventilation zips on my shoulders because I don't sweat from the chest down, all of these weird and wonderful things. Someone said that that'd be really useful for their running jacket, because when it's raining, they want to dump heat without having to take their coat on and off. So it's awesome that kind of the things we're exploring in a more personal space for me might have a knock-on effect, hopefully, to help other people. And I think one of the biggest things is just seeing someone who's clearly less able than you in these places kind of proves that it's possible, and hopefully will inspire other people that maybe they can do it too. Because it's one thing seeing Spider-Man and Spider-Woman like Leo up in those places, but actually if you see a big wobbly guy who you know you can walk better than, hopefully will motivate people to go, well, you know, what's my excuse? Because I think these areas, these places, you know, and Leo's proved that with the work he's done with his family and his kids as well. You know, want to open them up to more people and get more people in those places, because it's such a powerful place to be.
Leo, you've done some pretty hefty sort of alpine climbing with your wife and two little kids. How do you do that?
Well, it's not really alpine climbing, because, again, this is for the BMC, so we can get into a bit more technicality than you would normally. Alpine climbing generally suggests snow and ice. Tend to avoid the snow and ice with the kids. They are pretty small. Jackson is now 5. Freya has just turned 9. So tend to stick to rock. You might be in an alpine environment, but try to avoid the snow and ice, because one of the biggest hazards in the mountains is ordnance, falling rocks and falling ice. So I must say, like, yeah, we've done some pretty gnarly stuff with the kids in the last few years, but it's very selective. You need to be pretty clever about what you choose when you're bringing tiny little people into big, scary mountains. So a couple of years ago, we did the North Ridge of the Piz Bedil, which is 1,000 meter tall, very impressive peak that you wouldn't expect 3-year-old to do. But it is a very sharp knife-edge ridge, which, although that means it's very exposed, it means you're very unlikely to get hit by anything falling from above because you're on a knife-edge ridge. This summer, we did a thing called Stettind in the north of Norway, a much harder route, which is, you know, it's 500 meter tall rock face. And we did it over 2 days, so we slept on the cliff together. There are a few technical tricks which have made it a lot easier. And again, this is for the BMC. So there's this technique which is catching on in the States now, which is called fix and follow. And instead of the traditional way you climb a large rock face, which is the leader goes up first and then the partners follow on a belay from above. And you tend to climb as a two or a three, and you can use two ropes or one. But it means if you want to climb as any more than a three, it's quite difficult, basically. And climbing as more than a three is a notoriously time-consuming and difficult thing to do, especially if the pitches are long. You can't tie someone into the middle of the rope. Someone can trail a rope. It just all gets a bit clustery and difficult. But this fix and follow trick, the leader goes up first, and then you fix the rope. So you tie the rope to the cliff. And then what I do is I then come back down. So I normally go up first with the bag, and then I come back down. And then with the Progress Capture device called a micro traction, you attach yourself to the rope and you all climb up together next to each other. And it's really catching on in the States as a way to climb instead of the second coming up on top rope. It doesn't really work well with two ropes. It's much more suited to climbs that you can do with a single rope. But for family climbing, it's a total game changer. It's a technique that's been developed for extreme ascents. But I've repurposed it from the hardcore stuff to the opposite end of the spectrum to doing stuff with kids. What it means is instead of dad being up at the top of the pitch yelling from 50 meters above, put your hand out there. No, not that way. The kids not being able to hear you, them getting stressed, mum being there next to him trying to deal with two kids, and then the wheels quickly falling off and everyone screaming and having a horrible experience together, which will be a lot of children's experience of climbing with their dads. I come back down and I'm right there next to them. So you can literally show them where the holds are, or if they start getting scared, you're right there, dad's there, and you're attached to the rope. It's safe. So you can reassure them that it's safe and you can physically help out.
And it's so you're both attached to the same rope, or yeah, you're on one rope.
All four of us are attached to the same rope. And you re-anchor it in places on my way back down. And then I can technically help them with moving past things. And I go first, then, now Jackson's climbing, so it's usually me, then Jackson, then Freya, then Jess, my wife, their mum at the back, and we all go up together on the same rope. So this fix and follow trick, it is quite an advanced technique that I wouldn't recommend for everyone. You kind of need to be an experienced climber and know your stuff. The main hazard being that when you're belaying someone, the rope's always moving, so there's not one section of the rope. If there is a sharp edge, which there often is on climbs, it's not the same section of rope that keeps being put on that edge. The rope's moving, so it's a lot less likely to cut the rope. When the rope's fixed and there's four people on it, if there is a sharp edge, it's the same bit of the rope that's being worn. So that's just a major hazard.
I can feel the fear rising in my chest as you're describing this.
Yeah. So I carry some rope protectors for that. You refix the rope in places. You don't just have it anchored at the top down for 50 meters. Anyway, so it's a bit more advanced, which maybe I'll do a little tutorial on it at some point for the BMC or something, because it is kind of a game changer. There's no way that we would have been able to do the North Ridge of the Peasby Deal or the South Pillar of Stettind, all these big adventurous climbs with young families without this specialist technique. But that's the technical side to it. The other side to it, and similar to what doing with Ed, it's just when you're super competent and super experienced in a realm, it enables people like Ed or my kids to kind of piggyback off that, so that you can get into places and feel pretty confident and pretty safe. Right, we've done enough together now, Ed, so that it's scary. But I'm sure we wouldn't have got to the top of the Dibbner if we hadn't have felt comfortable with each other's competency. And it is a real, I'm 42 now. I've been doing this for a long time. And as Ed was saying, as a professional, to keep pushing yourself to attain new standards and new limits, it gets very difficult both physically to improve and also, you know, I keep saying you try to limit the risk, but ultimately, yeah, some of this stuff's really dangerous and it will only lead to one place if you keep pushing in the same direction. So it's kind of, I've definitely found more recently, it's a real pleasure to share the experience. And so you get, you know, you can be a bit of a psych vampire. Ed gets so psyched up in the mountains. It reminds me of being a kid basically and experiencing those things for the first time.
I think, you know, it's not lost on me how lucky I am to be climbing with some of the best people in the world. Like, that is obviously, that's a luxury I have that not a lot of people have, but as beginners especially. But I think more than that, I think it's just climbing such a great metaphor for life for me. You know, it's like the more you're willing to get out of your comfort zone, but you've got to surround yourself with good people. There's teamwork involved. Look, it doesn't matter how, you know, I'd read up on Leo or how good I knew he was supposed to be. The first time I went climbing with him, he still asked me to step out over 1,000-foot drop. And I've only just met the bloke. And it's like, and all my body's saying, you're going to die. And you have to put that trust in other people when you're climbing, which is something that I also think is a really cool aspect of it. There is a lot of teamwork involved in the type of things we're doing. You know, obviously you can go off soloing and stuff. That's different. But I really like that. I come from a team sport. I think you win and lose together. And like when you're stood on top of a mountain or you're halfway up a cliff or you achieve, so you have a big day out or you've broken some new boundaries, which seems to be what we do for me personally every time we go out, doing it with a group, and now, you know, a group that have become good mates, you know, is way more rewarding than doing it by myself.
How has that fed into the work that you're doing with your charity, Ed? Tell us a bit more about Millimeters to Mountains.
I was realizing not just the physical, you know, rewards that I was getting from being outdoors and challenging myself, but the emotional rewards as well. It was massively helping me deal with such a life-changing, you know, time of my life. You know, I kind of lost my identity and purpose. I was a professional sportsman, and then I was basically the exact opposite in a matter of seconds. And having to cope with that and refind myself, the outdoors is a massive part of that. And not just the outdoors, but adventure and being in amongst these amazing groups of people. Like I said, it started with Snowdon with 70 people around me who I didn't know, but then, you know, we were going on these trips then to the mountains to raise money for the spinal unit, and then I just thought, you know, if this is working for me, why can't it work for others? And there was also a weird element of guilt involved that I had all of these opportunities in this support network that a lot of other people didn't, and people I knew, people I was on the spinal unit with for months, and I wanted to just pay that forward. So we started Millimeters to Mountains to take people, initially people who had similar traumas to me, because my network was in spinal cord injury, but were at the end of the spectrum where they were, it was possible for them to go on walks and get outdoors, but they might not necessarily have the confidence to do so, to take those people away to the mountains, and then to, and basically just as a healing tool. But it's evolved from there. We became an official charity in 2020, beginning of 2020, and I realized actually this isn't just about physical injuries. This is, well, all we're doing is trying to get people in a place where they're excited about their future, they have purpose again, they see some progress out of a rut. So this is now turned into, we're more of a mental health charity really, and we help people who've been through any sort of trauma, physical or psychological. So we've got people who with PTSD, who have had bereavements, who have had physical injuries, anything that's knocked them off their path in life to get them back on track. So we take them on adventures all over the world. This year we've been to Nepal, Morocco, Iceland. We do walks in the UK as well. Part of that is to encourage them, you know, from not, one of the first things that happens when you're struggling, especially psychologically with the trauma, is you tend to retreat within yourself, and it's encouraging people to come back out and become a community and be around other people who have also been through trauma, to share their experiences, but also to do it in the outdoors on these adventures, getting out of their comfort zone, realizing they're more capable than they thought they were. But we also realized that actually just taking someone on an amazing trip and then saying goodbye to them afterwards isn't necessarily going to change their life, because people will often slip straight back into where they were before over a matter of time. So we put a 3-year program in place then where we fund life coaching, retraining, therapy, whatever it might be, to then cement that change. So it starts with the outdoors and an adventure, but then goes into a program where we put practical steps in place to help them change their lives. And we've got 16 beneficiaries at the moment, and I'm pleased to say it's working better than I ever even imagined. And we get to go on amazing trips all over the world with incredible people. And, you know, it's not just the beneficiaries that come on those trips. They make up 30% of the trip. And then the rest of the trip is made up by fundraisers or supporters of the charity who get to know and see how their support is working, because they get to know the beneficiary. And it actually is quite funny. Most of the people who take the most from our trips aren't even the beneficiaries. It's the people who come along as supporters and go, oh, my God, I didn't even realize how much I needed that. Which is really cool. So I run that with my wife Lois, and next year we're going to Petra in Jordan, we're going to Norway, we're going back to Nepal. So yeah, I mean, I never imagined my life would be running a charity, especially not one climbing mountains. But I think once you have to, I was resuscitated 3 times, and I think that gives you a bit of a reality check where you're like, you know, it could all end tomorrow, and it makes you question what you're doing with your life and what's really important to you. And I found I love climbing mountains, and I found that I really enjoyed helping people. So I was like, why not try and combine the two? And that's what's happened, and it's actually worked, surprisingly. So yeah, really enjoying it.
That's very cool. And we will have all the details, websites and links, if you think that maybe you would be a beneficiary of Millimeters to Mountains, or you know someone, you want to find out more about the charity, they'll all be in the show notes and on the BMC website under Finding Our Way. Okay, so guys, what is next for you both? What's happening? What's on the radar next? Leo, I know you've just written a book, haven't you? So off you go.
I have. In fact, it comes out tomorrow. It's called Closer to the Edge. So I am on tour with that for the next month. Yeah, it was a right pain in the ass to write, to be honest. There's a lot more sitting in front of a computer and a lot less playing out in the hills than I would have liked for a good chunk of this year, really. But it's done, and I'm pleased with that.
You went on an expedition just at the end of the summer 2022. Are we going to see a film about that, or any articles, anything like that, where we can learn more about your adventures?
Yeah, there will be something coming out next year. We can't really say too much. I'm not sure how much I'd like to say about it at the moment, but there's going to be something coming out in the summer next year which will cover all of that. So yeah, excited for that too. But I'm doing a session. Leo's got a couple of sessions at Kendal as well. I'm doing a session, hosting a session on adaptive adventure on the Saturday afternoon, which will be announced soon. So hopefully can see some people there.
Brilliant. Okay. This episode will be out before then, so we'll include links so that if you want to get tickets to see Leo and Ed, then you will know where to head. Thank you so much, both, for your time. Have you got more expeditions in the pipeline? More plans, more fun, more adventures?
I know Leo's got some ideas to hang me off some even bigger stuff, but we'll wait to see what they actually are.
Yeah, ideas at the moment. They haven't quite formed into plans yet, but I'm pretty sure we'll be doing some more stuff together.
Brilliant. It's very cool. I like the way you guys roll. It's awesome. Okay, so as is traditional with Finding Our Way, we're going to finish with 10 quickfire questions. So answer quickly. Let's have answers from each of you. That'll be cool. Okay, so question number one. Describe yourself in 3 words. Ed.
Fun. Laid back. That's 2 words. Yeah, there you go. 3 words.
Driven. Fairly laid back as well. Tenacious.
Nice. Ed. Favourite mountain snack?
Ooh. Summit sausage.
Right. Make that what you will.
Yeah.
Leo, best climbing memory?
Oh, my God. I don't know. Getting to the top of for a new route on El Cap was called the Prophet, which was a long dream and hard-earned.
Ed, bucket list destination?
Patagonia.
Leo, how often do you get lost?
Rarely.
Ed, your dream climbing partner, obviously separate from Leo and your gang at the moment. Do you have someone you want to climb with?
I've got so many of my mates to introduce. A guy called Tom Suter. That's going to mean nothing to any of you, but if he ever listens to this, I'm calling him out.
Okay, there you go. Leo, if you were an animal, what animal would you be?
Peregrine.
Ed, one of the things that you always carry when you're on an expedition with Leo?
Earplugs.
Leo, what does climbing mean to you?
Gives you a purpose to go to wild places and do some pretty wild stuff with wild people.
Lastly, chaps, we want more of you. Where do we go? So share with us your top social media or websites.
Ed Jackson 8 on all socials. And then if you're on my Instagram, there's like a link tree to every like podcast and website and things like that.
Thank you, Ed and Leo. And thank you for listening. If you liked what you heard today, why not check out our shows from season one? And you can subscribe so you don't miss an episode of season two. You should also probably share the podcast with friends and let us know what you think. Use @teambmc on Instagram and Twitter and the hashtag #FindingOurWay. If you want any further information or links to the stuff that Ed and Leo have talked about today, head to the BMC website and you will find show transcripts and notes. I will see you on the next one. Finding Our Way is brought to you by the British Mountaineering Council and is kindly supported by Berghaus. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Marianne Hotter, edited and mixed by Chris Stone, and the show notes were compiled by Tom Bennett.